Well, I'm very delighted to have in the studio in 2025 for the first time my friend Dr. Simon Carruthers of the Old Fire Station Surgery in Beverley. Welcome to Beverley FM in a new year. Did you have a good Christmas and festive season?
I had a lovely Christmas, thank you very much, Terry, and happy new year.
Thank you. And I understand that you were not on duty over the festive season. The first time in how many years?
36 years, Terry, so it was absolutely wonderful to experience Christmas like the majority of the population of the UK. Tremendous.
So you were able to catch up on what we're going to talk about today, which is sleep.
Indeed,
or shall we say the lack of it. Because there are some people that just cannot go to bed to sleep, and some of us go to bed and sleep and wake up in the night and then can't get back to sleep. So the first question I suppose to ask is, why do we actually need sleep?
Yes, thank you, Terry. So sleep is obviously essential to us. It's a time when the body rejuvenates and repairs. Interestingly, it's also thought that it's a time that we organise new knowledge and memories, and perhaps even in certain phases of sleep, even stimulates our creativity. So it is really important for us. It's one of the real pillars of good health. We know that if you're not sleeping well, that it has effects on your cognitive abilities. And as we all recognise, it certainly has an effect on your mood. I know that I'm generally quite grumpy if I've not slept very well. And in addition to that, there's increased risks of physical illness, such as certain cancers, blood pressure, cardiovascular disease and diabetes. So it is really important that we try to sleep well.
So if we sleep well, do we dream well?
The answer to that is probably yes. Yes, sleep actually occurs in cycles, and most people, I think, believe that you're either awake or asleep.
Right.
But that is not the case. When you are asleep, you move through a cycle of approximately 90 minutes in duration. You pass from dozing into light sleep and then progressively into very deep sleep. And it's the deep sleep which is the restorative part of sleep, usually about 20% of the sleep cycle. And then as you come out of that, you go into what's called REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep. And it's during that phase that we dream.
Well, clearly sleep is very important to us. So how much sleep do I need?
Well,
Margaret Thatcher, she used to survive in about 4 hours. Didn't she?
So they said, yes, she was the famous insomniac, wasn't she, Margaret Thatcher?
Yeah.
But I think it's difficult to say for any one individual how much sleep that you need, but on average, about 7 to 7.5 hours seems to be the optimum.
Yeah.
Now, the problem we have in the UK at the moment is that the average adult is probably getting about 6.5 hours sleep, and it's estimated that about 30% of people have less than 6 hours sleep a night. Now, the averages in 2024-25 are about 1 or 2 hours less than they were in the 1930s. So people are now sleeping less than they used to. And I do wonder to myself whether this might at least partially account for some of the increase in physical and mental health issues that we are seeing now. That's just a postulation, but it might be the case.
So preparing to go to sleep, what shouldn't we do first of all? What should we avoid?
Yes, so I think there's a big one to be spoken about, which is the 21st century problem of screens, that so many people now spend so much of their time staring at their mobile phones, their iPads and their laptops. And it seems that this mechanism whereby these screens emit what's called blue light, and blue light essentially mimics daylight.
Right.
And what daylight does to your brain
is... I begin to see where you're going on this one.
Yeah. Well, it reduces the production of a hormone called melatonin. And melatonin is the hormone that is responsible for us going to sleep. Generally, our so-called circadian rhythm, the circadian rhythm is the 24-hour cycle that we all go through, which controls our temperature, it controls our digestion, it controls our hormonal production. 24-hour circadian rhythm generally promotes the production of melatonin in the sort of mid to later evening, stimulating sleep, and then as the early morning hours come, the melatonin levels drop off, and then we start to wake up again. Now, with blue light stimulation from screens, what we're doing is artificially reducing our melatonin levels, which, of course, then acts to keep us awake.
Mm.
So one of the simpler things that you can do, and actually I say it's simple, but I think most people would find it extremely difficult, is to put your screen to one side at least 1 or 2 hours before you propose trying to go to sleep.
Yeah.
My wife actually has taken to locking our mobile phones in a box in the evenings. She accuses me of scrolling too much. I'm as much an addict as anybody else, and our phones are now locked in a box for the evening. I have to say, early days in the experiment, but it seems to have helped.
Does that include televisions then?
Yes, I think it does. However, I think the your mobile phones and your iPads, etc., generally held much closer
defenders
to your face, and the intensity of incident light is probably that much greater than watching television.
Because a lot of us have a television in the bedroom, watch the news and then go to sleep or try to go to sleep.
Yes, and the sleep experts would say you shouldn't actually even have a television in your bedroom. Your bedroom should be kept clean of clutter and particularly screen devices.
I'm being told off again.
Sorry, Terry.
So what can we do to sleep better then?
Yeah, so I think the first thing is prepare your room to be a comfortable environment for you to sleep in. And the number one, I think, is get your bed right.
Right.
And getting the mattress right.
Well, we're going for a new mattress on Thursday.
Okay, well, then you can put my advice into action there. Now, when you go into the bed shop, the salesman, of course, will try to sell you the most expensive mattress in the shop.
Right.
The one with 10,000 springs and yak hair filling and all that kind of stuff. But you don't need the most expensive mattress in the shop.
Okay.
You need the one that's right for you. So how do you know which one is right for
you
is the next question, isn't it? So
I mean, they do encourage you to lie on them, don't they?
Yes, they do. And how do you judge is the question. So what you want is the one that gives you the right amount of support. It neither needs to be too hard or too soft.
Right.
And how do you judge that? The best way to actually judge it is to lie on your side in the fetal position, that is with your knees drawn up and your arms folded in front of you, and ask your partner to take a photograph of your spine. And what you need is for your spine to be in a straight line, that is your neck going down through your thoracic spine into your lumbar spine.
Right.
And what you'll find, if the bed is too hard, then your head and neck will be pushed well away from the mattress.
Oh.
And if it's more than 6 centimetres, that mattress is too hard for you. If it's too soft, your hips will sink into the mattress and your spine will be curved into the bed.
Yeah.
So what you're looking for is the mattress that supports your spine in a straight line with you laid on the mattress with no pillow.
I can see this is not going to be a 2-minute job on Thursday.
No. you're going to have to take care. We're taking photographs of each other. The salesman will probably think, what the hell are they doing?
I've never come across this before.
Yeah, what in hell are they doing? But believe me, that is the best way of doing it.
Yeah.
When I discovered this piece of advice myself, I went to lay on our bed and my wife took my picture. And thankfully, it is actually...
I thought you were going to say it failed.
In a straight line. No, it didn't fail. Amazingly, we chose the right mattress between
More by
us.
Coincidence than luck.
Yes. Yeah. So that is the first and single most important thing. You spend a third of your life lying on that mattress, and so it needs to be comfortable.
And I was interested before we came on air when you were talking about my cup of tea. You know, I do like a cup of tea with my dinner, but I have my dinner about 6 o'clock, and for some people that might be too late, you said.
Yes. So if you can, you need to avoid caffeine containing drinks for about 6 hours before your
proposed
sleep
time. So if I go to bed at 10 o'clock, I can't have a cup of tea after 4 o'clock?
No, ideally not.
Oh dear.
Ideally not.
What am I going to do?
Now, it might be, Terry, that you can sleep perfectly well with your tea time cup of tea, but for those people who are struggling to sleep, you should try and avoid caffeine for 6 hours before sleep time.
Right.
And the other thing to avoid particularly is the energy drinks.
Right.
Energy drinks are high in either caffeine or taurine, which is profoundly stimulating. And if you're drinking too many of them, you have very little chance of getting
What about alcohol, though?
Yes. So alcohol, as we know, sedates you. But what I think it also does, it interrupts that natural sleep cycle that we told you about.
Yeah.
So when you have alcohol, it's very unlikely that you get into that natural rhythm, particularly with the deep sleep that we mentioned. So you might be unaware of your surroundings and to all intents and purposes, asleep. but you're not getting the proper restorative aspects of sleep.
I can certainly relate that, because I do enjoy my tipple of whiskey. And I find that when I go to bed and go to sleep, I can sleep for about an hour or so, an hour and a half, and then I wake up.
Yes.
And is that the effect of the alcohol going away?
Yeah, possibly. Yeah, it possibly is. Remember I said the 90-minute sleep cycle? So it's very interesting, actually, because at the top of the peak, as you come out of REM sleep, you are then starting to wake up.
Yeah.
And a lot of people do actually wake up briefly during that period. So it is quite normal to wake 3 or 4 hours a night.
Yeah.
Now, for people who are affected by insomnia, i.e. they struggle to sleep.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what we could do about that, yes.
When they get to the point where they become awake, rather than just relaxing and thinking, I'll now go back to sleep again, they get into a bit of a panic because they've now woken up. They start to get anxious because they struggle with their sleep. And then as soon as they start to get anxious, of course, what happens next is that you then start to get sort of hyper-arousal in your brain. You start thinking about things. You start getting more anxious about what's going to happen during the day, and so on and so on and so on and so on. And your chances of going to sleep are limited. So in those circumstances, what I recommend to people is that they try and do what I call controlled breathing, which is the best way of describing it is 7-11 breathing. And what that involves is breathing in and out through breathing in through your nose and out through your mouth. You breathe in through your nose to a gentle count of 11 and out through your mouth to a count of 11, and focus entirely. So all your thoughts have to be focused entirely on the breath going in through your nose and out through your mouth and that sensation. And if an anxious thought starts to intrude, focus all your thoughts back on that sensation of gentle breathing. And it sounds like it couldn't possibly work, but take it from me, who is one who has had times when I've struggled to sleep. Mm. It does actually work remarkably well.
Oh, that's very, very interesting. So I've got a friend who asked the question about obstructive sleep, and is it apnea?
Apnea.
Nearly got it right.
Yes.
What's all that about then?
Yes, so obstructive sleep apnea syndrome, to give it its full full terminology, is actually caused by laxity in the tissues of your upper airways. And particularly to people who sleep on their back, and their partners will probably tell you that they snore a lot. As you become more deeply asleep, as you go down that escalator that we talked about, the tissues in the back of the neck become very floppy, and then in the worst circumstances, they start to obstruct the upper airway.
Right.
Now, what happens then is that obviously your body senses that you've stopped or stopping breathing, which in general circumstances is not a good thing.
No.
So it starts to wake you up again. And then you start to slide back down in sleep again, and it starts to wake you up again. These patterns of respiratory arrest occur. Now, of course, what that means is that you never are able to enter the deep sleep phase to get
the benefit of it.
So the restorative part of sleep, the bit of sleep that makes you feel refreshed when you wake up the next day, does not occur.
No.
And so people with obstructive sleep apnea, the thing that they complain of the most, that they come and see us about, is feeling tired all of the time, and particularly feeling sleepy all of the time, so that they may find themselves falling asleep in circumstances where it's not a good thing to fall asleep. So they might be in a meeting, or even, God forbid, in the car.
I was going to say driving,
And so this is a big problem, particularly for people where being hyperacute is really important. So professional drivers, airline pilots, doctors, etc. Although I think a lot of people would say, I'm not sure my GP was that hyper-acute when I went to see them a couple of weeks ago. But it is a big problem.
Am I right in thinking that there is some kind of gadget that some people wear to help the breathing at night?
Yes. So when we see people who we suspect have obstructive sleep apnea, the first thing we do is basically ask them a series of questions to assess how sleepy they actually are and in what circumstances they're likely to fall asleep. And if they score highly on that, we can then arrange for them to have various tests that they're monitored overnight to see what happens with the pattern of breathing. And if it proves that they have apneic episodes, then they can be provided with a special machine that essentially they have a little mask that goes over the nose or the mouth, okay, which blows air all night into their upper airway to keep it open.
Right.
And that is called a CPAP machine, or continuous positive airway pressure machine. And they are remarkably effective, actually, that the people do notice a significant benefit. Their sleep quality is improved and they feel much, much more awake. Of course, there are lifestyle things that they should be doing as well. Generally, people with sleep apnea, although not always, are somewhat overweight, so you need to try and encourage people to lose some weight. If they're smokers, they should try and stop smoking. They should cut out nighttime alcohol for the reasons that we've already mentioned. And sometimes you find that almost the lifestyle measures, if they're very successful, can be enough. You need to encourage them also to try and sleep on their side, because people who sleep on their backs are more prone to apnea than people who sleep on their sides as well.
Why can't you just give me some tablets?
Yeah, that's a question that we get asked an awful lot.
Or some better tablets than what I've got now.
Yes, so sleeping tablets generally can be effective in the very short term. So if somebody has some sort of acute life event, they have a bereavement or loss of job or major problem in their life and
trauma,
they're really struggling to sleep, then I think it's fair to give out a few sleeping tablets to help them get over that. The problem with sleeping tablets is the more you take them, the less effective they become.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. I mean, how long does a sleeping tablet actually last? I mean, you know, it takes you to sleep.
Yes.
How long can I expect to sleep, or is it just to get you...
No, most people will actually stay asleep for a good period of time, so maybe 6 or 7 hours, so they feel they've had a better sleep.
Right.
How it affects the actual sleep cycle...
The natural cycle, yes.
I think that's open to debate.
Yes.
And the sleep that you get is probably less restorative.
Yes.
And the more you take them, the less effective they become. So, but the problem is that people become psychologically addicted to them. So not physically so much. So if you don't take them, you don't get dreadful withdrawal symptoms. But you become psychologically addicted in that you believe...
I can't get to sleep because I've not had a tablet.
Get to sleep. Yeah. And it's far better to spend the time to discuss the ways of improving your sleep environment, avoiding caffeine, avoiding blue screens, getting the temperature of your room right, etc., etc., etc. The problem for us as GPs, of course, is that our time is limited. And to have a full discussion about it is long and drawn out. I'm afraid to say that sometimes it's the easier option just to give people the tablets.
Well, do you know, after all that talking about sleep, I'm beginning to feel quite tired. So I think we'd better draw this little chat to a conclusion. But thanks ever so much for popping in. It's been very, very informative. Very fascinating, actually.
Yeah, well, I hope that's been helpful. And go and have a cup of tea.
I'm going to find a dark room and go to sleep.
And have a little nap.
No screens.
Before you go home.
No television. No alcohol. Well, thank you very much indeed, Dr. Simon Carruthers of the Old Fire Station Surgery in Beverley. And in a few weeks' time, you'll come back and talk to us about another fascinating subject.
I'd be delighted to, Tony.
Absolutely. Thank you very, very much indeed.
Okay, my pleasure.
We do appreciate you. Thank you.
Thank you.